vote against me, I will find you. You can thank Google Earth for that.
Hello there in internet land, and welcome once again to the D&D Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Merles, and with me as usual is my co-host, Jeremy Crawford.
Hello everyone.
Today we're talking to Forgotten Realms novels line editor Susan Morris about an adventure she wrote for our website, Heroes of Hesiod, which is aimed at younger D&D players, maybe a chance for a parent to introduce a child to D&D. And after that, we're going to talk a bit about the creature competition. And we're also going to take a few questions via the mailbag. So sit back, relax, and here you go with the show. So Susan, why don't you introduce yourself to our audience and tell us a little bit about what you do here at Wizards of the Coast.
I'm the line editor for the Forgotten Realms at Wizards of the Coast, which means that all the books that you read in the Forgotten Realms, I've touched in some way.
So now, with this adventure now, Heroes of Hesiod, which you mentioned in the intro, why don't you tell us a little bit about how this came to be?
Well, for the past, 6 years, I've been working with kids in various ways. Early on, I ran adventures for kids at game stores, and I started out with Basic 3.5 and moved on to 4th edition when we started doing 4th edition, and I really found what the kids seem to enjoy. At first, I tried to steer them away from anything violent by having penalties for hurting the monsters, and you had to, capture the monsters and everything, and really large role-playing components. But I found that what kept their attention the most was monster hunting, monster slaying. So I wanted to try and get that down to its essence so that it was fast-paced to keep their attention, knowing that the kids are going to add their role-playing. They're going to add the crazy stuff that, you know, they always will, and basically provide a platform for them to play.
And when you say kids, about how old are these players?
Usually five mm-hmm. and up.
Okay.
So I've also worked with teaching kids in various formats, and really found that simple structures allow them to flower. The more that you restrict them with really complicated rules, even though they can do it, it often inhibits their imagination. Mm. They get more concerned with, you know, beating the game than with working with each other.
Yeah, that's something I think adults do too. But, you know, it's interesting you made the point about how kids, you know, the appeal of the monster hunt. Because I know when I was a kid, I think there was this divide between the media that I consumed, the movies I wanted to watch, and the movies that I was supposed to watch. I mean, I'm kind of... My family was odd. My mother really liked horror movies, so I grew up watching Texas Chainsaw Massacre and stuff. But
and this is why you ended up the way you did.
Exactly. My lovable self here. But things like, say, Care Bears, whatever, I had no interest in that. And even watching the G.I. Joe cartoon, it seemed a little weird that the violence was so sanitized. They never showed anyone actually getting hurt. People just had guns always shot out of their hands and stuff. So it's sort of interesting that you would make that point, because for me, as thinking back to when I was a kid, it definitely rings true. That when I played, you know, my first exposure to D&D when I was six, to me, it's, and of course, I go into the dungeon and fight the monster. I don't, have this sort of, it's almost like adults want to believe that kids want this kind of touchy-feely, the monster's just this misunderstood ragamuffin and you're going to pet it. The kids actually want to do something that's maybe a little more unsettling maybe to adults in some way. I mean, I don't know if that's...
Or maybe a mix. I mean, because I think I've played with kids as well, and the kids also enjoy the story of rescuing that ragamuffin. Mm-hmm. But they also want to go slay the dragon.
Yeah. It's important to differentiate between good monsters and bad monsters, too. Yeah. When I was a kid, I had the My Little Ponies. But the My Little Ponies were the heroes fighting against the evil Barbies that were trying to take over the world. So there was violence, but not quite in the way you'd expect.
Right.
So you have this experience, and so you have this basic idea. And so now, if someone's out there listening, how can they get a copy of this adventure?
Well, it's posted online at our website at dungeonsanddragons.com. And you can read more about it, actually, if you go to our book club, which is at the Watsy Novels Book Club on our community site. There you can find interviews with the author. You can find a short story that the game is actually based on called Training Day. And you can also find information about the book that it links up with, which is called Monster Slayers by Lucas Ritter.
Oh, cool.
And Monster Slayers is related to our one of our survival guides, right?
Yeah, it's actually related to a practical guide for monsters.
Oh, practical guide.
To monsters,
right.
Yeah. And that's actually a fun prop to bring along if you're actually playing the game. Because you can say, oh, you're fighting the Beholder, and this is what the Beholder looks like. This is where it lives. These are its eating habits.
Mm-hmm. So now the adventure has proven fairly popular with people out there. I know it's been tens of thousands of downloads of it. Are there any plans in the works for any expansions to it or a sequel?
I'm really glad that it's touched a chord, and I would absolutely love to do more work on it. I think there are a lot of aspects in D&D that we can kind of showcase in these mini adventures, and love to see where we can go with that. So if you like it, please tell us what you like about it. If you have anything you'd like to see in the future, please let us know.
And also, listeners, if you have questions about, hey, how do I run a game for players who are around 5 or 6 years old? Please send those in, and we can handle some of those questions in future mailbag sessions.
Yeah, exactly. We can always grab Susan for another podcast.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks a lot, Susan, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, turning our attention now to the tournament bracket, our creature competition. If you don't know, we basically took 64 notable D&D villains and threw them in a bracket tournament, kind of like the NCAA basketball tournament.
And these are villains from across the D&D cosmos.
Oh, we got guys from Dark Sun, Forgotten Realms, from everywhere.
Dragonlance.
Yeah.
Planescape.
Well, they've been battling, and we're now down to our final eight. So we have four matchups. So we're going to run through, and I'm going to try to get opinions here from Jeremy. And I'll, of course, offer my own opinion of who he thinks is going to win each one. So coming out of the first bracket here, I think this was like the sort of like wizards and priests bracket. It's not – my little sheet here doesn't have it, but that's what I think it was called. We have Halaster Blackcloak, famed builder of Undermountain, taking on the Symbol, who is someone I believe – wasn't she the Chosen of Mystra for a while?
That sounds right to me.
I gotta admit, I know more about the Realms villains than the heroes, because I played the Realms more often than I DM'd it. So I never really knew besides like Drist and some of the more notable figures. So Jeremy, who's your pick? Who do you think is going to take this one home?
I would have to pick the Symbol.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm sorry to say that you're wrong, because Halaster's going to win. All Halaster did was build Undermountain, one of the greatest dungeons of all time.
Yeah, but I always favor Galadriel-esque figures.
You would, wouldn't you?
Yeah, she will crush him with her powerful beauty.
I don't
beauty.
Think she'd crush him with her beauty. Halaster's crazy, though. He wouldn't know beauty from horrid ugliness. I don't know if that would even help him, right? I mean, that sounds more like something he had to go to therapy for. But, okay, so anyway, so that's your pick. So we're against each other on that one. And then our next bracket, I believe this was Devils and Demons. Because looking at this bracket, I'm seeing a lot of powerful outer planar beings. So we've got Tiamat, Queen of Dragons, taking on Lolth, Demon Queen of the Drow. Who do you go with in that one?
First, I have to say, I think this bracket was rigged.
Because
I noticed, looking back, that the Lady of Pain somehow lost, which is an impossibility, in my opinion.
Well, no, the problem there, if I understand, was the Lady of Pain, that was a Lady of Pain, not Plain. It was a
She's
road
also the
game.
Lady of the Plains.
Yes, in Spain, where she falls on the plains. Well, that was the problem. It was a road game. She had to leave Sigil, and she can't, right? She can't leave Sigil, can she?
She could have just invited them all there.
Yeah, but it's a road game.
There?
But it's a road game. Oh. So that's, yeah, she didn't show up. That's why she lost. That's all, the only
so
way,
it was a forfeit.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Because I agree.
That's the one way I can accept the Lady of Pain losing is if it was a forfeit.
Because in the first round here, she beat up Caius. That's pretty impressive. Then she beat up Demogorgon. But then she lost to Lolth. That's not going on.
Well, and so really it was a no-show. Lolth.
Yeah.
Lolth was supposed to meet her in her demon web pits.
Yeah, but she can't go on the road.
Yeah.
So who do you think wins between Lolth and Tiamat?
Oh, Tiamat.
You
all
think
the
Tiamat,
way.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think so too. I have a fondness for Tiamat. Lolth is like, yeah, you know, she's powerful, but, you know, Tiamat's got how many heads? Five? Six?
She has five heads. She's a goddess. I mean, so is Lolth, but Tiamat, she's more powerful. But, hey, if Venger were in this competition...
Venger is actually... He's already won. Like, he's like the Hall of Famer. He's been retired. That one horn and the big thing.
See, I think secretly Venger is the brother of the Lady of Pain.
No, Venger actually, wasn't he the Dungeon Master's father or something?
No, he was the Dungeon Master's son.
His son? How did a guy that short have a son that tall? That's odd.
This is one of the wonders of the magical world of Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah, I figured maybe like back in that medieval times, they didn't have like genetics yet or something. No. So whatever happened.
Genetics had not yet been invented.
You know, they had more primitive stuff to work with back then. So now moving on to the third bracket here, we have Artemis and Treri versus Drellaxel. So, you know, another point of trivia, which I think is really interesting, Drist was the exact inspiration from Drist comes directly from first edition AD&D. In AD&D and Unearthed Arcana, drow characters could wield two weapons without penalty. That was in the rules. Drist was a completely legal character. For like the time when that book was published, the first Drist novel, The Crystal Shard, he was just a first level D&D ranger who happened to be a drow.
Right, and the interesting bit of that trivia is he was a two weapon wielder not because he was a ranger.
Exactly,
it's because he was a drow.
Because he was a drow.
It was later that became a part of the ranger class.
Yeah, little known rules, but it's right there in Unearthed Arcana if you dig up a copy of it.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go with in this one. I'm going to go with Drellaxel because he's just kind of a tricky guy. I mean, Artemis is pretty tough. I mean, he stood up to Drist. He's fought him a few times, I know. But I always like Drellaxel. I think he just has style. Like, I kind of respect the guy. So
I don't know. Maybe Artemis's namesake will appear from...
and fire an arrow.
This goddess will appear and protect him.
All right, so that's our third bracket. Our final matchup is the deity bracket. Undead bracket. The Raven Queen is not undead, and neither is Vecna. That makes no sense. Vecna's kind of a lich. She's a god. It's really tricky, right? Well, anyways, it's Raven Queen versus Vecna.
So, okay, we can accept that this bracket is undead-themed.
Yes, yes. Yeah, it's a little... There's a few guys I'm looking at this black bracket who aren't quite undead, but we'll let that slide.
Again, I do think this bracket was also rigged. The fact that gods were tossed in against poor Strahd and Lord Soth. Really?
Yeah. Well, yeah, the Raven Queen did beat down Strahd. That's pretty impressive. And who did Vecna take out? I have to actually go to page 2. See this. Vecna took down Orcus. Wow.
Yeah, I accept that.
So who do you go with then, Raven Queen or Vecna?
My gut instinct is the Raven Queen, mm-hmm. because she's the goddess of death itself. But Vecna's been around for quite a while, and he is a tricky fellow.
He is tricky. I want to go with Vecna, because first, his name just sounds cool. It just sounds nasty, right? I mean, you know, it's kind of like the thing where, like, when he was born, what should we name our kid? Could we name him, like, you know... Dougley Goodheart or Vecna, right? I mean, they kind of set the kid down the path of evil with that name.
Well, maybe his name really was Dougley Goodheart.
And that's when he changed his... Like, the horrible reign of terror of Dougley Goodheart just wasn't going as well as right. he knows.
And so when he attained lichdom...
Brought in a consultant, maybe like got a naming firm.
He was christened Vecna.
There you go, Vecna. Well, that's a good name. And I want to go with the classics. I gotta say, I'm a sucker for him, so...
All right, so Tiamat, we agree on... In the Tiamat versus Loth competition, we disagree on Halaster and the symbol.
Yes. What about Vecna versus Raven Queen? You haven't given an answer.
Oh, I said in the end, I think Vecna.
Okay, we agree on Vecna.
I think in the end, his cunning will gain him the victory.
And then Drellaxel in our final bracket. Well, we'll see. If this is now, judging by my performance in past brackets NCAA, I will have all of those wrong. So. If for some reason you're betting on this, just take the opposite of what I've just said. So anyways, that is the bracket. So get out there and fill out your brackets and be sure to buff the people you voted for because you can do that. You can go and buff them. It gives them a bonus to help take down who they're going up against. All right, so that's our recap of the creature competition, the bracket up on the website. And now for our final segment on this podcast, we're going to dive into the mailbag. And this is something that we want to maybe make a regular part of the podcast. We know the mailbag has proven to be fairly popular with people. So instead of just doing like once every few episodes doing a big mailbag, we'd like to maybe just start doing a mailbag as part of every episode. So keep in mind, if you have any questions, throw them to dndinsider@wizards.com. and we'll throw them in the queue for the mailbag. So anyways, starting off, our first question comes from Eric. Eric asks, and I'll paraphrase and just read the entire email, but how do blast or burst powers work in a 3D environment? For example, does Burning Hands create a 5x5x5 cube of fiery destruction? He also asks, what about character height? Does a 6-foot-tall human occupy 2 squares vertically, or how about a Goliath who's almost 8 feet tall?
You want me to answer this one?
That's why I asked you the question.
So the answer is that, yes, areas of effect are cubes. Unless we say otherwise, that Burning Hands is indeed filling a 5x5x5 cube with fire. And so that Sturge or whatever it is that's flying above the wizard, well, since this is a blast, it wouldn't be above the wizard, but wherever that blast is going. It could be above the wizard if the wizard shot the blast straight up. But yes, they're cubes. As for the space that creatures occupy, a player character is as tall as the character is specified on the character sheet. So if you've decided that your character is 6'2", that's how tall your character is. Now, your character's space for the purpose of combat, which is essentially the space they need to be functional in a combat encounter, is specified by their size category. So, you know, a medium creature, even if they're, you know, 6'2" tall, occupies a 5-foot cube on the battlefield.
So even if the figures, if you picture it in real life, the character would be above it.
Right.
For purposes of the rules, we just assume that you are, even the Goliath isn't actually 2 squares tall.
Right.
He's just 1 square tall.
Right. And again, that's not the creature's height. And it's important to make the distinction in our minds between the space that a creature occupies is not the same as how big the creature itself is.
Yeah.
I mean, because similarly, you know, unless a creature is a gelatinous cube, it is also not horizontally filling its space. You know, I don't know many people who are, you know, 5 foot wide.
Yeah, I don't think, even like a goalie in hockey with all his gear on, I don't think he's 5 feet wide. So,
yeah.
And everyone with taste likes hockey. Bart.
And so again, you know, a creature's space in particular is an abstraction. It's how much space it needs to function in an encounter.
So as a DM, you should feel free just to say, like, if someone puts a blast over a pit, a 5-foot deep pit a character's standing in, it doesn't affect him. It just goes right over it.
Or the DM might decide it blasts down. If
that's
the blast
true.
Is big
that's
enough.
That's the DM's prerogative. Yeah. But just general DM is just like, I'm just going to run the rules as written. He would just assume character takes up one square.
Right. And also just as a general principle, when people are interpreting our rules, which admittedly sometimes can be a little arcane, if we say something like, hey, close burst one affects each square adjacent to the character who created it, we really mean each square adjacent. So we're not secretly meaning just the ones that are on a horizontal plane.
Yeah.
We really mean each adjacent square. So that means the squares above the character as well.
Now, I have seen, I don't know if this is a power that's been out at least in the wild yet, but I have seen a power that specified that this only affects people standing on the ground in this area.
Right.
And I think it was some sort of like web or tentacles from the ground kind of effect.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. All right. So that covers that. And we have time for one more question. So, Jared, why don't you pick one to throw my way?
All right. This question comes from Billy, I believe. Yeah, this is from Billy. And Billy is wondering, basically, how much do creatures know about the effects of powers in the game? So, you know, particularly if, let's say, a defender marks someone, or even probably more to the point, let's say a soldier monster marks a player character, how much does that player character know about that marking power's effect? And then by extension, what do that character's allies know about that marking effect?
So this is obviously gets out of the strict rules, more DM advice. So I'll preface this by saying really whatever works best for your game is what you should do. The way I like to run it, and I feel this way both as a DM and as a player, is I like to look at an effect of a power, and I will describe all the effects that occur within the power unless the power specifies otherwise, or if logic clearly dictates otherwise. I emphasize the clearly in that, so my default is always to tell the players everything that has happened unless I see a good reason not to. So for example, I think one of the examples, a mark's a great example. I may tell and this actually happened just in a campaign of mine, maybe about a month and a half ago, that if a creature attacks a player's character, and marks it, I'll say you're marked. And usually what I'd like to say is maybe describe it a little more flavorfully than that. Say, you know, the creature flame lashes out at you, and as it knocks you back, it continues to menace and threaten you. You've been marked. But I might not say, and actually I wouldn't say, well, the creature also has an ability that if you move while you're marked, it gets a free attack on you. I won't tell them that. But I will tell them that everything that's readily apparent to the game at that moment, everything that sort of happened with that attack. So it's kind of a line between, well, what did this attack do? And then I don't want to give away, though, what may happen because of that attack. Another great example might be with a ghoul. You know, ghouls have a claw attack that can immobilize someone, but then they have a bite attack that does a lot more damage that they can use against an immobilized character. I wouldn't say, well, the ghouls immobilize you, and now you realize it can attack you for more damage. And there are times, too, when you look at powers, and it does take a little bit of some verbal acrobatics to explain exactly what just happened. I think one of the examples in the email was, you know, there's a warden power where the warden attacks and an ally nearby gets temporary hit points. You know, so I like to, if there's two effects like that that aren't necessarily directly tied into each other, I like to sort of cascade them together as almost two separate abilities. Like the warden attacks, and because he hit, he can create a rush of primal magic, you know, his sort of thrill of victory that he can then channel into a quick spell to give someone some extra vigor. There's another example of an assassin attack, I believe. That is, the assassin attacks, does some damage, and until the end of your next turn, the target makes a melee basic attack as an opportunity action against any enemy that ends its turn adjacent to it. And that I would describe, and I can't remember the flavor text that actually goes along with that power, but I might describe it as when you hit the guy, when you stab into him and channel shadow magic into him to blur his senses, and now in his mind, all his allies look like leering, fang, demonic creatures that he's afraid of. Your magic has pushed him into being so scared of that if they stay close to them, he lashes out at them in panic.
And I'm glad you bring up the flavor text, because in player character powers, at least, the flavor text is there precisely to help players and DMs describe what's going on in the world of the game.
Yeah.
It that is a hint for what do the adventurers and the monsters see that's going on. I do think it's a fair default, particularly in convention play or in organized play, to just have a default of the person who's affected by something knows what it does.
Yeah.
And I think in people's home games, I agree, it's really up to the DM to decide what's the right amount of information for his or her group. But I think it's a good default, again, in conventions, in game stores, in gaming settings like that, to just assume the targets of various effects know what's going on.
Yeah. And I think the important thing, too, to keep in mind is to make sure you apply it both ways. If you assume the target knows everything about what just happened to it, the player should know everything that happens to them. But by the same token, the monster should know everything that happens to them.
Right.
So the player marks someone, the monster should. Now, again, in the case of a fighter, the monster may not know that if he shifts, the fighter's going to hit him. But he should know he's marked. And, you know, it then just kind of depends. Well, this is a hobgoblin, say, for example, that got marked. Hobgoblins are smart. They're kind of crafty. This probably going to probably suspect something bad will happen to it if it moves.
Yeah.
As opposed to, say, a zombie, which may or may not know, or especially if it's a zombie that's being committed by a necromancer just to grab the wizard, well, it might just move by the fighter and take the attack.
But even if the zombie doesn't know, the DM should know.
Yeah.
I bring that up because I've seen sometimes players try to catch the DM by not telling the DM about some effect that's going to occur if, say, that monster steps out of the zone that the wizard just created.
Yeah.
I think it's good table etiquette for for players in particular to let the DM know what the effects are of their powers, because the poor DM is tracking all of the effects of the monsters and what's going on in the encounter. The poor DM know what's going to happen. Let the DM know,
and that is not being clever. That's just being a jerk.
Right.
And the DM really should just say, well, if you didn't mention it the first time, it didn't happen, so that doesn't work.
Right.
You know, that's not adding to anything to the game. Except that's like the basest measure of being like a clever player. And it's not a clever player, it's just being a jerk. Don't do that.
And plus, by withholding that information from the DM, not only can it be a jerk move, but it can also rob the DM sometimes of a great tool for creating some fun moments at the table. Because I know what I do sometimes, because I role play all of my monsters when I'm DMing, even when I know that stepping into that zone is going to do something bad to the monster. If I'm playing a really stupid monster, I will have the monster step in on purpose.
Yeah.
And it will often create either a funny moment, or it gives the players, you know, a sort of a victorious moment, like, we got them.
Yep.
And so that's why I think it's great to share the information, to give the DM all the tools he or she needs to make a fun scene. And then DMs, vice versa, even if the DM is maybe keeping an effect secret, as you were getting at, Mike, I think it's great for the DM to, at the very least, describe something going on in the scene that hints that something else is going to go on.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that the creature is crouched, ready to pounce. So the players don't know what's going to happen if that creature pounces, but they know, something else is coming.
Which can build up some nice, a nice amount of dread at the table.
Right.
Which is always fun. Well, that wraps up this edition of the D&D Podcast. On behalf of Jeremy, I'd like to thank you all for listening to our podcast. As usual, any questions, comments, or concerns, or questions for future mailbags, shoot those over to dndinsider@wizards.com. And thank you to Susan Morris for coming on to talk about her work on the Heroes of Hesiod. As usual, keep gaming and keep enjoying D&D, and we'll see you guys soon on our next episode.
And this is Bart Carroll signing off from the D&D Podcast as well, with a reminder to please vote in the creature competition if you have not already done so this week, with some belated campaigning from Vecna, who lost out this week to the Raven Queen.
What? What did you say? Of course I'm going to win. I can't die. You'll have to speak up. My ears are 3 centuries old. I got them from a merchant caravan.
One more interview we did not have time to include in our regular podcast was with another creature competing in the competition. Everyone's favorite kobold, Meepo.
Well, I think I should win because I'm really good with a dagger. I can use it to kill things, and I can use it to eat things. I can use it to eat things I've killed. And what? I've already lost? Why am I even here? I passed up a commercial to do this.